So it's with great pleasure that I'm able to introduce our speaker, Susanna Mayo from UCD, who has recently retired from a long and distinguished career in which she served in a variety of senior military and political advisory roles focused on the Middle East. Susanna began his career with the British Army in 1978 and held a series of increasingly senior roles until his retirement in July 2015. And most recently, he served as Deputy Chief of Staff, Deputy Chief of Defence Staff Operations from 2009 to 11, Defence Senior Advisor for the Middle East from 2011 to 14, and as the Prime Minister's Security Envoy to Iraq from 2014-15, and is now with Green & Co. as a senior advisor. I'm particularly glad to introduce Simon because he's an old friend. He's been a very welcome visitor to me when I was in my ambassadorial posts in Jordan and then in Egypt. And his knowledge of the region, and above all, his insight, his ability to take the big picture and go straight to the heart of what's really important, was vital in keeping the policy machine in London up to speed in what was a very fast-changing, environment in the region, and which continues to change. And I don't think we could have a better speaker than we have today on this rather sort of unchallenging subject, which is the Middle East, a region in flux in a world of
sound. Thank you very much indeed, James. It's a real pleasure to see James. His famed hospitality when he was the ambassador in Cairo, spent many time sort of talking about the famed policy making in London, I have to say. But there you go, the democratic overhang. I was given, a region in flux and a world in flux, just covered it in 20 minutes, can you, Simon? Because, my goodness, I think we are at a real pivot point in history. If you are a historian, which I purport to be, it's my great love, and I think it's a subject that has always fascinated me, as a rather bald thing to say. I like history. But I have to say, I've always loved the sort of causes and consequences that come out of historical trends. And while, as people say, history never repeats itself, that old cry, it certainly does rhyme. And I think we're seeing at the moment a really huge historical movement. It's another, certainly in my lifetime, this is yet another new world order. And I remember people being very critical of George Bush when he said it's a new world order and things didn't turn out quite as people were expecting. And the reality was, he said, there's absolutely no moral weighting to the word new. It just means different from the old one. It doesn't mean better, but we are inclined to call the new world order new, to give it at least some sort of moral aspect to it. But I genuinely think it is a new world order at the moment. And I think to talk about the Middle East, and I'll come on to that, you can't really talk about it unless one talks about precisely this flux that's taking place across the world. And a lot of it is to do with a questioning, and I think it's a questioning on a global basis, about the capacity, willingness and readiness of the United States to continue to underwrite the liberal world order, which it has done so since 1945, and particularly since 1989-91, and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I think we are moving into a very new era where we are living with what I would probably argue have been very poor policy choices almost since the end of the first Gulf War. I looked up the word flux on Wikipedia. You'll get about 25 pages of physics and whatever. And it's supposed to be the action or process of flowing or flowing out, which really doesn't really capture it. But then there was a much simpler one that just said it was a condition of continuous change. Everybody here looking at the hairstyles like mine, these expensive grey highlights, will probably remember, no, there's a few youngsters there, 1990, when a seminal work came out by a man called Francis Fukuyama called The End of History and the Last Man. And it came out just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and really almost while we were assembling one of the largest coalitions in history to expel Saddam from Kuwait. And it was seized on with huge enthusiasm by the West. And I was in the Ministry of Defence already looking at 30% cuts in the army, just as we were deploying the largest armoured division out to Germany. And Francis Fukuyama posited that with the end of wars of religion, certainly in the Western world, with the end of wars of nationality, frankly based on the EU and the Franco-German alliance, with the end of wars of ideology, with the collapse of communism, largely all the great battles had been fought. And for the next decade, we supped at the Kool-Aid. And there was a lot to actually underpin that thesis. We saw, obviously, the Soviet Union had collapsed. We saw issues of soft power attraction of liberal democracy, the triumph, really, I put in inverted commas, of the free market, rising globalization, huge technological advances, rising life expectancy, falling infant mortality rates, falling levels of absolute poverty, etc. Expansion of NATO, expansion of the EU, all these great institutions that we assumed were the way forward, where reasonable people would get round the table to discuss reasonable outcomes to reasonable problems. And in many ways, what we did, of course, and people remember the peace dividend, is we began the process of buying ourselves, disarming ourselves, and buying ourselves an unsustainable welfare state on the back of debt, with politicians of every hue in every Western country bribing the voter with their own money. And, of course, there was much good. And the 1990s is the time when we ran riot as liberal democracies, when the transatlantic link didn't need to be, frankly, challenged. It wasn't challenged. There were the Clinton years. It was the early. It was both the tail end of Major, and in comes the bright new Blair experiment. But it is worth remembering, and as a historian, that old cry, the one thing you can always rely on, or the only ism you can always rely on is pessimism, is that rather gloomy chap at the party who stands there sort of supping in the corner, looking a bit sort of downhearted, Samuel Huntington, came up with his book, The Clash of Civilizations. And, of course, nobody wanted to really look at that. It looked very retro at the time. We didn't really want to be confronted with any idea that, there were other civilizations. And, of course, he argued very strongly that although you didn't wish to generalize too much, it went into sort of, stereotypes and national characteristics, that there were areas of the world that did not, at the moment, buy into liberal democracy, and by that I use a shorthand for a whole range of assumptions, and that people had very strong senses of identity based on a sense, obviously, of cultural development and historical experience. And his line was that actually the West had triumphed not because of its value, not because of its values or its ideas so much, is that we were better than anybody else at organized violence. That is why we won. Gloomy. Who wants to think about that? But in the meantime, while he was putting that out there and said, we have really got to be careful that we are not just in a moment of history where we have a set of ideas just happened to have won the headlines. But it was absolutely on the back of American firepower, if I just want to characterise it. And he took a map, and I say, you could throw maps up, and I'll come back to that, and it had basically, the transatlantic link, the dumbbell of the transatlantic link, America on one side, America, Canada, and the Western European countries. Obviously, it had South America, different sort of social, cultural, historical backgrounds, sub-Saharan Africa. And then the three that I'd say absolutely critical to examining the world today, when it comes back to the clash of civilizations. We don't really like that, but we've got to sometimes find ways in which you take this world in flux and give it some coherence to understand it. He took the Orthodox world, take Greece, take Serbia, and of course take Russia, the Soviet Union, deeply wounded, deeply scarred, deeply psychologically damaged. The Sino-civilization, broadly, 95% Han Chinese, huge sense of imperial history. And of course Islam, for whom, I know there are many Muslims in this audience here, for whom, of course, the division of the Islamic world, largely by virtue of imperialism and spoils of war, First and Second World War, is viewed by many as one country, the Ummah, the worldwide community of Muslims. And he argued that all of these would, if they had a chance, frankly, push against the constraints, as they would see them, of social liberalism, of the free market, and of the idea that Western ideas have triumphed. And my challenge, my proposition would be that at the moment, as a result of a combination of arrogance, a policy making that has ignored history, a deliberate desire to believe, as I say, our own propaganda, where we've moved, as I say, from being prepared to defend our, if you want to use a catch-all, civilization, or our construct, by buying ourselves, as I say, an unsustainable welfare state. The wars of 9/11 and our response to them, in which we've racked up huge amounts of debt to no strategic advantage, has put us into a position where there are direct challenges now to the post-Cold War settlement and what we assume to be shared assumptions about the liberal world order. And I put the major ones, and funnily enough, Huntington had them, Russia, China, Iran within Islam, obviously as a very separate branch, Persian Shia. And I think they are all driven by selective inspiration and selective grievance. And I think the challenges we have in the world anyway would be difficult enough to tackle, even if we were still on a teleological upward path of international institutions and shared assumptions. Climate change, population growth, migration flows, economic fragility, economic inequality, etc., etc., would be difficult enough even if the EU was still that preeminent regional player, if NATO was still confident, if we had a transatlantic narrative that still rang true, if the United Nations was still working. But when the world is in flux, then, my goodness, these become increasingly difficult to take on. And so many of those issues come back to the Middle East. US politics has got very personal and very divisive. I was in Texas last week, and I would say the only hope for Trump, whatever we think about Trump, is he may have a magic wand in which we can get the American economy going on the basis of which the whole global economy rests. If you look at European politics, my goodness, whatever we thought of Brexit last year, you see nothing yet until we start entering the French presidential elections, the general election in the Netherlands, the German election, the Greek debt crisis, the Italian debt crisis. So all of this means those dumbbells I was talking about, North America and Europe, absolutely begin to lack conviction at the moment. And then you take the Russians with their ambition, and they look back. We look at Russia and we say, oh, Putin, gosh, he's a really tough bugger. They're leaping back over the Soviet Union era. They're back into Catherine the Great. They're back into Peter the Great. They're back into, this is a civilization that has been absolutely insulted for the last three decades. And my goodness, we feel we owe you, nice people, while you're working out your own problems in the European Union, no favours whatsoever. And to see Russia back in the Middle East in a most extraordinary manner, and the Americans just invited to Astana as an observer, is quite remarkable. And I just saw today they're just going to do a joint fighter deal to build a fighter with the UAE. Now, these are parts of the world where we thought if it wasn't the Brits, it was going to be the Americans. No longer. Syria, with Egypt, with obviously Greece, with Cyprus, with Serbia in the Balkans again, in the Middle East, etc. Really, really huge. And of course, while we were asleep, Russia, lousy economy, demographics all against it, but at the moment, you know, the old cry, it's the economy stupid. No, it isn't sometimes. It's identity politics and your cultural certainty. That's why Putin has an 80% approval rating. Whatever he does, frankly, it's about the cultural identity and the historical entitlement of Russia. China the same, 4,500-year history, the Dash 9 line, as people know out there. And if anybody's seen, and I suggest you look at it, the One Belt, One Road aspirations and ambitions, it's really quite frightening. It's really, really quite exciting if you're a Chinese to see what your ambition is around the world and your capacity now to actually achieve it. And the buying up of the major ports on the major hubs around the world is giving them an extraordinary leverage in the buying up of big raw material aspects. I was in Afghanistan, and I remember the Afghans selling a huge copper mine for about £2 billion. $2 billion, doesn't matter. A lot of money. Looked a lot of money. And, of course, what the Afghans wanted, of course, was that they began to produce. So there was a revenue stream coming on board. And, of course, the Chinese said, oh, no, thank you. You know, we've got plenty of copper. We're buying this up. We might start producing something from this in 25 years' time. Well, again, it's a sort of mindset about how you push forward national ambition that is very firmly to do with you, you know, your historical cultural aspect. And then you can throw North Korea into the mix. And my goodness, how that would destabilise. So that is the sort of context, I would argue, this challenge, certainly from the Russians and the Chinese, very understandably, on the basis of historical entitlement. And when you go back then into the Middle East, having set that as the world in flux, oh, and it is worth saying, the Brexit vote, the Trump vote, these are also expressions of historical entitlement as well, by large sections of population who are feeling also slightly cast adrift by some of these, as I say, the Kool-Aid we've been drinking since 1991. There are three cries I always like to throw out. One is geography is history. Where you are depends on what you do and what is done to you. And if you take the Middle East as I describe it, from the Nile Delta in the west over to the plateau and mountains of Iran in the east, go north to the Tarsus Mountains and the Anatolian Plain, and then south to the Saudi Arabian Desert, then you're left with one of the great cockpits of history, which is, of course, from really the Tigris across to the Mediterranean. And so that is where the great flows of history have come. And, of course, in more recent times, the geography is not only the physical geography which constrains or channels movement, it is the fact that 50% of the world's accessible energy reserves now sit on that. But they don't just sit in a nice, benign area of the world where we can guarantee we can get at them. They sit on one of the most volatile areas, politically, religiously, culturally. And the big wars being fought out there. And I don't mean just kinetic wars, but I mean wars of ideas, gender wars, generational wars. And if you accept that geography is history to an extent, you also have to accept that history is politics. What has happened to you and what you have done to other people largely determines how you view yourself at the moment. And I could show you any number of pictures of any number of empires in that part of the world, be they Parthian or Achaemenid or Safavid or Ottoman or Abbasid or Umayyad or almost Fatimid. And they all overlay each other on the same bit of ground. And if you go out to Baghdad, for instance, which I've spent a lot of time there with the Americans, what you find, of course, is the same conundrum you had in the British Empire in India. Do you sit on the Tigris? Do you move forward to the Euphrates? Do you go forward to the Syrian highlands? Do you go forward onto the Mediterranean and coming the other way? It's exactly the same in India. Do you sit on the Indus? Do you go to guard the passes into Afghanistan? Do you go into Afghanistan? And so you're constantly, every movement has been drawn through that area. They overlap on each other. And of course, by the end of the First World War, after North Africa had largely been carved up out of the Ottomans, you're left with an area where you've pushed the Ottomans back into the heartland of Anatolia. The Iranians have been pushed back onto their plain. The Arabs proper, as it were, have been pushed down into the deserts of Saudi Arabia, and the Egyptians on their Nile, back in the Nile Basin. And what have you got in the middle? The construct of Syria, of Iraq, of Transjordan, the mandate, of course, for Palestine and Lebanon. And so all the elements of an Egyptian, Arab, Persian, Turkish competition, which have been sat there the whole time, these are just the ethnic competition, the ethnic sense of entitlement through generations absolutely predating Western civilization, and my goodness, predating American involvement, are all there. And then you throw over that ethnic competition, which is very alive all the time, the confessional confrontation between Shiism and Sunniism, remembering, of course, that for a long time Shiism was very firmly an oppressed minority. Funnily enough, the Protestants looked like that in the 16th century to our relationships with the Ottomans. And then you find at that stage that the Safavid dynasty under Ismail Shah in 1502 actively, as almost a pushback against the fact that this great empire, this great Persian empire, had accepted Islam from the Arabs, the pushback is the adoption by the Persians of Shiism as the state religion, in a manner that Constantine adopted Christianity as the state religion. So suddenly this Turk-Arab-Persian dislike, confrontation, conflict, which has been running again for hundreds of years, then takes on this idea of heresy against orthodoxy. And then, of course, running through Sunnism, so yes, we all up to a point get Shiism versus Sunnism, you get the Takfiri ideology, goes all the way back to the Battle of Siffin in 657. The Kharijites, those who leave, those who look on most, a bit like Bolsheviks, the state will wither away. These political constructs are all illegal, illegitimate, etc. And out of them, in the most modern parlance, grows, of course, Al-Qaeda, and now the Caliphate of the Islamic State. So that is running through with that, and to an extent it blows up when those internal issues to do with Takfiri ideology, and of course the real enemy is the House of Saud, rather than ourselves, we're quite a useful kicker, is of course 9/11, and then the Western intervention, with the luxury that there were no other challenges to us, the intervention into Afghanistan, and then the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And of course, the 2003 invasion of Iraq, again, for those of you who studied the early thing, I think it was Xerxes, or I think Darius, one of them, Xerxes, I think, who goes to the Delphic Oracle and says, what will happen if I invade Greece? If you invade Greece, O great emperor, a great empire will fall. The trouble was, it was his, not the Greeks. And one wonders if George Bush had gone to the Delphic Oracle in 2003, whether we would go, whoa, hang about, we've seen this one before. And we, of course, went through the sort of breakup of the occupation of Iraq. I think any of us, again, who'd studied history would have said, if you're going to take this Persian-Arab-Turkish confrontation, Sunni-Shia, you're going to know, I hope, that Baghdad is the great capital of the Abbasid Caliphate, one of the great high-water marks of Sunni-Arab leadership of Islam, before they lost it to the Ottomans in 1517. And you are going to guarantee to hand it over to the Shia, the heretics, and when you hand it over to the Shia, you're fundamentally handing it over to Tehran. Are you sure that that is what you want to do? And so many of our Sunni Arab friends tried to warn us about this. And of course, with the chaos that came out of Iraq, Syria, we then were again confronted with the Arab Spring of 2010, end of 10, with the Tunisian orange cellar. And we're now left with this absolute chaos. Again, just take the idea, you've got Turkey fairly stable. Well, we can have a view about that. You've got Iran, of course, you know, firmly where it is. You've got Saudi Arabians as the leaders of the Sunni world. And, of course, then you've got, you know, the Egyptians under Sisi. So the four big blocks that I talked about earlier are still there. And this band of chaos through the centre, which has led, of course, to huge different set of alliances, particularly as the Americans have largely withdrawn from the battlefield. So we've seen the problems of intervention in 2003, and by goodness, we've seen the problems of non-intervention since largely the chance we had in 2013 when we failed to cross the red line over the use of chemical weapons. The last time I felt, and I spoke about this at the time, that we lost the initiative then to be a major player in that part of the world. And of course, in that, again, as I mentioned before, in this area that is really, really very, very important to the world because of the energy supplies, we are now seeing the Western influence, which we took for granted, the American position, which we took for granted, being unsettled. And when I was in America last week, you know, of course, they are quite excited about the fact that they are going to be energy independent and actually that the advances in technology will continue to drive down oil prices. The danger, of course, if you then take my third line, geography is history, history is politics, demography is destiny. And if you have sustained oil prices in a single sector economy, you will really give the countries of that part of the world, and particularly I think the Gulf allies, who we know extremely well, it could be our friends from Iraq, etc., real difficulty to handle the challenges that they've been set by the sheer demographic numbers. And the statistics are just out of sight. Median age of Western Europe, 44 and rising. Median age of the Middle East, 22 and falling. 30% under 15, 60%. Call it what you want, under 30. Going from 365 million to about 600 million. No jobs, really, no economy necessarily. If you have a sort of public services that can't employ them, you end up either with people who are going to start moving, and those great movements have begun already, with all the implications for European societies and domestic politics this coming year. Or you get the attraction, dare I say, of whatever happens after we dispose of ISIS in Mosul and Raqqa. And of course then into that region you throw the other players, the Christians, the Druze, the Yazidis, the Kurds, of course, promised their homeland in 1922, never got it. Women, and the great issue of how you properly, particularly in the Gulf states, release 50% of your human capital. Those issues, particularly when you are heavily constrained by the ulema, your religious authorities, that the secularists against the against fundamentalists, and I remember again in Baghdad or in Iraq, you know, an active attempt to assassinate doctors, technicians, technical people, educators, etc., because they're the last people you want proselytizing a new view of how the Islamic world might change. And the consequences of the Middle East crisis, really, we've undermined American reputation. Very sadly, I speak as the most wholehearted transatlanticist. If not America, who? We've seen the rise of Russia. It looks like a reliable ally, and it's very socially confident and socially conservative. We've seen a deepening split between Sunnism and Shiism. We've seen a deepening split within Sunnism. We've seen the rise of Iranian regional power. Of course, they have Damascus, they have Baghdad. They are fostering the troubles in Yemen. 25 million people in Yemen. Most people think it's 2 or 3 million. And of course, Hezbollah and they continue to use, of course, the Arab-Israeli conflict, however you want to define it, in Palestine, to talk over the heads of the Sunni Arab leadership. Huge opportunity for China. First new Chinese base going into Djibouti. They have a base in Guador. They have a base in Myanmar. They're looking to make sure that those oil supplies continue to come to them, on which their own political stability depends, on the basis of continued economic growth. So a combination, as I say, if you buy a proposition that we have a real challenge to our assumptions about the sort of Anglo-American, Western European-American model from Russia and China in particular, who've been creeping up on the inside, or hardly creeping up. And then you take into that what is going on in the Middle East, as I say, both today's problems that will be exacerbated by these huge demographic growths. You can see the undermining of our confidence and our trust in our own institutions. General Rick Shinseki, who was a great hero of mine, Chief of Staff of the Army at the time of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, argued for 400,000 troops. He said, "You will not be able to do what you want to do, oh, Mr. Rumsfeld." Mr. Rumsfeld was determined to drive down the manpower numbers. And, of course, he proved you could overthrow a regime with much smaller numbers. What you couldn't do is implement a phase four. His great line was, "If you don't like change, you'll like irrelevance even less." My big worry at the moment is that we do not have the capacity to change fast enough, given our institutions, given the debt burden we've got, given the movement away, as I say, from active defence of our, inverted commas, civilization, to, as I say, an unsustainable welfare state, and to intervene in a manner that controls, broadly can control events. And as a last one, I remember I was with David Petraeus in Baghdad once, and he had on his wall a very impressive, classic American picture of a stampede called, unsurprisingly, The Stampede. And he said, "This is what it feels like, Simon. You know, there's the cowboys, that's us, and in there's this great thing, and the lightning's flashing, and we've, you know, there's the media there, and there's the Jaish al-Mahdi there, and there's the Anbar there, and al-Qaeda in Iraq, and our own politicians." And he said, I really think we need, you know, what I need around me, Simon, is men who are comfortable in a stampede." And I went off and I got an absolutely immaculate photograph of the Serengeti crossings, the great wildebeest, which is an absolute cluster on the banks of the Serengeti. I said, your stampede looks a little bit too orderly to me, General. That looks a bit more like what we're in the middle of." And I think at the best, we go back to, we're in a stampede at the moment. We need to be comfortable in that stampede. We need to have a view of, you know, some coherence as to what we're facing. And I think at best, we just got to find, we hope, a way in which whatever stampede we've got, this flux, that we're at least in a position to bring some form to it that allows us to have some influence, not simply in the middle of some great chaos in the middle of the Serengeti Desert River. Great, James, thank you very much. I think I'm just about on time there.